Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, one of the things that certainly we know is that there are a lot of Americans that don't get as much physical activity, as much exercise as they should. And we all know certainly that there was a very clear relationship between your health and the level of physical activity. Now, if you ask this question, why is it that people aren't more active? There could be a number of answers. But one of the things that we'll be talking about this morning in this part of the show is this relationship between the way that our communities are designed and opportunities for being physically active. And really looking at this question, is it possible that the way that communities are set up either discourages activity or makes it more difficult? Or by the same token, by doing things differently, we can actually make it possible, give people more opportunities to be physically active. Our guest for the program is someone who is well known as an expert on this relationship between the built environment and physical activity. And his name is Richard Killingsworth. He is director of a program called Active Living by Design. It is a national initiative. It's supported with funds from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And the idea is to promote physical activity through thinking about community design and transportation and architecture. He also serves as associate research professor in the Department of Health Behavior and Health Education at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Before that, before he took up his current position, he was in federal government for a number of years. He, in fact, was health scientist with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and was the lead interventionist on CDC's Active Community Environments Initiative, which is basically interested in the same sort of thing here that he's involved with Active Living by Design. He's here in Champaign-Urbana to take part in this year's U of I Planning Institute, and the theme overall is Community Design for Healthy Lifestyles. It's being hosted by the U of I's Department of Urban and Regional Planning. It's the sixth year for the conference. He's one of a number of people who are here in Champaign-Urbana to talk, and we're pleased that he could stop by here and to talk a little bit with us. Questions, of course, are welcome, questions and comments. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, good morning, David. Thank you for having me.
Are there actually ways in which the built environment, the communities in which we live, discourage, work against physical activity?
Well, I think we see it every day in the environments that we pass through. And it's quite common that we'd walk out of many places in which we live, in which we work, in which we go to school to see an environment that presents an obstacle and a barrier to do the very thing that we want to do. Mm-hmm. Be very physically active within it, going out walking, bicycling, or even very common everyday things, using facilities in and around our homes, parks and trails and green space that many of us did when we were young, but now are presented with an environment that discourages that behavior to happen regularly.
Yeah. Is this something now that people who do planning are starting to think about?
This is a tremendous emerging movement that we see growing rapidly across the United States, in which we see a convergence of many different disciplines that are looking at this very closely because they see that opportunity of building synergy across the many things that we do in our professions, public health, city planning, transportation, architecture. All recognize, and I see the potential of coming together and really looking at how they can work more closely together to build a place that has a sense of community, has a sense of experience, and provides things that people are begging for that go well beyond what we're talking about today, which is physical activity. Mm-hmm. But a community provides a very livable and sustainable experience for all that for the people that live there.
So basically what you're talking about is trying to promote a kind of a design that makes it more possible for people to walk, to run, I suppose, to bicycle, to doing things that are both related to fitness and transportation that give people the opportunity that lead them to be physically active rather than, I suppose, driving the car would be the default method for an awful lot of people.
It seems like that's how we've designed our environments, though, is really around that one mode of transportation. And we really haven't considered designing places around the human and how we need to thrive in an environment, what our very basic needs are with regard to physical activity and just moving through that space. But it's all intuitive when you think about what we're looking at here. This is common sense stuff, and unfortunately, common sense is missing in many of the plans that we've designed over the years with regard to how we function as healthy humans. And we've built an environment that if you just walk out, we can see the basic barometer for what a livable community is seeing children at play and seeing older adults moving through it safely. And I would say the litmus test for most communities, if you see an absence of those populations within your community, there's something severely wrong going on.
Mm-hmm. Can this all be traced to the emergence of the car as the dominant form of transportation? And seemingly everything is really designed, cities, big, small, the way we lay out communities, even when you drive down residential areas, the way things are set up, you see this place was created for the car. Is that really, do you think, what the bottom line factors?
Well, I think that would be the easy thing to finger point at. And I would try to avoid doing something like that because I think it's a system that's built upon many convenience factors and labor-saving issues. The human, quite honestly, is a very lazy being in that we seek out convenience over the opportunity. And you think about how we've got here today. Most of us drive to locations that are very close to where they live or where they work, but we still rely on the automobile because we're programmed to do that. We think about how we enter buildings. We look for the elevator or escalator as opposed to the stairs. It's basic programming that we've come to know over time. And I think what we're trying to do here is build in a system that presents an opportunity over much of the labor-saving and convenience factors that we've built into it. But we have a huge hurdle. Technology is running rampant, and we need to recognize how it fits more compatibly within our lifestyle to where we can be healthy and at the same time still have these technology available to us to provide the resources that we need.
Mm-hmm. Can you give an example of some place where you think that they've done a really good job in incorporating these kinds of features into the design of the community?
That's a very common question I always get asked. You know, where is the ideal place?
Yeah, where's the perfect place?
Where's the utopia? And I always counter that by saying that these places exist everywhere. Champaign is a great example of a place that's trying to do good things. It's built on a grid system. They have a very walkable environment in many locations in and around the university. They have a bikeway system. But there's a lot of systems that can be better connected to make it thrive even more. Then we have places that are always raised as the ideal, like Boulder and like Seattle and Portland. And even those places, though, while they are the ideal in most people's minds, they do have pockets where there is bad things going on. So I would argue that we don't have to necessarily look hundreds of miles away for the best place. That often is just around the corner of where we live to see how that is working very well. The idea is how we grow that on a much larger scale locally and seize opportunities of building in systems within the networks that we have in our local communities. How does transit function? Does it best serve the economy of that community? How can we better enhance walkable environments that connect people to the places that they go, like schools and the university and stores? And how do developers respond to the needs of people to have more choices about where they live?
Maybe I should introduce again very quickly the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Richard Killingsworth. He is director of Active Living by Design. This is a program. It's funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and they're interested in promoting physical activity through community design and looking at this issue that we've been talking about. That is, are there some things on the one hand, some ways that communities are designed that tend to discourage or make it more difficult for people to be physically active? And then the other side is, well, are there some things that you can do to actually create activities, promote physical activity, make it a little bit easier for people to do that? In addition to his involvement with this program, Active Living by Design, he is Associate Research Professor in the Department of Health Behavior and Health Education at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and is here visiting in Champaign-Urbana for this conference that I mentioned at the beginning of the show. That's the U of I's Planning Institute for 2005, looking at community design for healthy lifestyles. Questions here are welcome. Questions, comments, you want to call in, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, given that maybe there was no place this perfect, tell me about some of the places where you can say, well, here's a place where at least in this feature or in this place, they've been successful and are making progress, and this is what they've done, just so people can kind of get a little bit more concrete idea about the kind of things that we're talking about.
Sure. If we're trying to set a vision for what we're looking for here, and as I mentioned earlier, it's about how we integrate systems that complement one another, and we'll use the Boulder experience as an example of this, where they've truly integrated a system where all modes of transportation are compatible, where it's a robust system where it provides people choice to choose very freely and openly how they want to move from place to place, whether that is walking or bicycling and using transit or using your car. But they have developed an extensive network for the transit system to fully support all those modes, where it's connected to the bikeway system and to pedestrian access that provides people to go to destinations that are real, that they need to get to, work and shopping and the university. And unfortunately, we build these systems often that are disconnected to many of the places that people need to get to because of the way we have developed our land. Clear separations of where people live and then where people work and where they go to school. And the distances are so vast that it's difficult for transit to support that. But Boulder has built a wonderful system where the land is used effectively, where there's a good mix of uses. The densities are appropriate enough to support transit. So they're providing a system there that people enjoy, that they respect, that they value, and are willing to pay for, and because they see the sustainability and the opportunity in that system. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a vision that started long ago, and it's same for places like here and elsewhere across the United States. It's the idea of getting people, the public, to buy into this vision, understand its true potential. And quite honestly, most people see the initial onset of the cost. It's quite expensive to do what we're talking about, but if they realize the true return on that investment down the road, they would recognize that it is less expensive than the system that we have in place now.
Yeah. When people have had the opportunity to design communities from the ground up, this is one of the kind of things that they think about, and I'm sure that we can see some examples around the country where designers and planners have actually had the chance to do that. They've started with nothing, and they've said, What are the kind of values that we'd like to have in our community? And they have, and I'm sure that this thing that we're talking about is part of it. They want to make it possible for people to walk between their homes, their work, places for recreation, places to shop, places to go to the movies, places to go have coffee, you know, that kind of thing. And that is one of many features that end up being designed into some of these new planned communities. So if you're starting from the beginning, I could see that would be easier. Is it actually possible to, in a sense, to retrofit? Can you go into existing communities that have existing infrastructure and by making changes incorporate some of these features in the built environment that you've got to start with?
Yeah, the immediate answer, David, would be yes, that's where probably the prime opportunity exists. And unfortunately, it's very expensive to engage something like that. But the new communities that we're talking about, these new urbanist communities that are popping up across the U.S., really only reflect 1% of all the developments going on. And that's why it's in such high demand. That's why it is so costly to put in place. But yet, you're talking about an alternative to this approach and going back into our older cities that may be decayed and need to be revitalized. And this is where the opportunity, I think, and the potential is for this movement is going back into these places and creating an environment in which people want to come back into the city and live and work and enjoy all the opportunities and amenities that metropolitan areas provide people. And I think that's what we're talking about. It's not going out and doing building in green locations. It's going back in and building in brownfields that have been abandoned and decayed. And really revitalizing the energy of that the surrounding community. And we can see this in prime examples in many locations. Stapleton Airport, for example, in Denver, where this is now the nation's largest redevelopment project. They're going in and changing what was once an airport location now into a massive mixed-use development that really accommodates the needs of most people, where there's a mix of uses of residential and commercial and retail and schools and parks. And I encourage people to look at that vision for what they have there and how they can do something for redevelopment within many metropolitan areas across the U.S.
We have a caller. We have a couple, in fact. So we'd welcome others here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means that no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call, use that number and we'll pay for it. And that's 800-222-9455. The first caller is in Aurora. That's line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, I live in a very old community. My children all went to a school here, which is about three blocks away, maybe less, and they all walk to school, and they walk to high school, which was a mile away. Very frequently they walked. And now they're trying to have busing in the community. And I feel like you do, that one, the cost will be high and push up taxes, and two, they'll just, the air will not, you know, will just have some more contaminants in it, and is that good for the children? And so I have not, I'll have to honestly say, gotten into it, because I feel at this time, I've done a lot of work for the school district, and I just thought that the people that are living here will have to fight for what they want for their children. And, of course, I am, as I said, against the busing for the cost, the polluting of the air, the cost, and the fact that should have come first, that the children are better off walking and to school and getting a little bit of exercise before they sit down for the next several hours. So that's what's going on in our community, and I don't know if you can reverse that trend with the fact that I suppose they are thinking that the streets aren't safe. What do you have to say about that?
Well, you're certainly addressing a very passionate topic for many people across the U.S. That in this issue of safe routes to school and this bygone behavior that we all experienced when we were growing up, of having the opportunity of walking to our neighborhood elementary school, is truly impacting many communities. Less than 10% of children now walk or bicycle to school across
really?
The United States.
Oh,
so
my.
It's and I often ask this question in my presentations, and how many people when they were growing up walked or bicycled to school. And often it's the adults over 40, 90%
yes.
or more
yes.
raise their hand. But when I ask the question, how many of their children or do they know of children presently walking to school, that number often few hands raise at that point. And I think what we're recognizing is that we're designing an environment where we're siting our schools away from the heart of the residential community, off on the periphery of most municipalities. And then we're relying too heavily on parents chauffeuring their children in or taking the bus into school, that we're not only missing opportunities for physical activity, but for many other beneficial outcomes.
Yes, yes.
That you and I—
camaraderie on the way to school is very important.
Right, and just for them to recognize what is good and what is bad on that route to school about their community and the environment that surrounds where they live and how they can make change. So it affects not only a lot of physical issues, but also addresses a number of mental issues for our children to get them engaged in their community at various levels. So I would encourage you to stay involved with your school district.
No, I can't. I'm sorry.
We need to find somebody then to take that role.
I get the papers, but I've been involved in so many things that I've let other important things, issues go, and I have to, I feel that I've kind of what they say, you throw the ball to the next person. Well, I've thrown the ball, and I hope somebody catches it.
Well, I hope so, too, because you're identifying a very important topic for the sustainability of your community. And hopefully someone in Aurora, where you're from, will have enough passion to pick that up.
Yes, thank you. And
thank you
for talking about it. I think it's a good thing to be happening, and I hope it keeps going. Thank you.
Right, thank you.
Well, I think that the caller obviously makes a very important point, that if you're talking about some kind of change, whatever that kind of change is in your community, you've got to get a substantial proportion of the community behind it. If you have a few individuals, no matter how hard they work, that's not going to do it. And I know this is something that you have written about, how to get communities involved as a community in promoting these kinds of things.
Right, and this is probably the most fundamental issue in making the success of this program that we're talking about is partnership.
Yeah.
And the caller certainly identifies her role that she had before in the community is really not interested in doing that anymore, and I hope someone in that community really picks up the ball and identifies the various partners that can really make this happen. And this is a difficult task in making and change to decisions that are grounded within policy or legislation or budget. In this case, it's hard to say what's making the call there, but clearly working with the school district concerned parents and others to make this a very important part of their daily transportation, I think, would be an effective process there.
Hmm. But it sounds like overall that you would say something like size of community doesn't really matter. You can do it in a large community, although you might have to think about it on the neighborhood level, maybe, more medium or smaller communities. That it's possible. It may not necessarily be easier, actually, if you're talking about a smaller community.
Well, I think you're identifying call to actions, you know, how people see themselves fitting into this larger, complex picture of making change. And so for the callers that are listening, it's the idea of what change can they make first and foremost in their home? How can I act as an individual and as a family in making decisions around this opportunity of creating places that are better for not only physical activity but many other health outcomes? And then it's looking at the neighborhood scale. Are there coalitions or partnerships that they can engage and make decisions around this to make their neighborhood safer and better and more activity friendly? And then on a more regional scale, it's connecting with those larger coalitions that are making decisions around policy and around funding of these very important projects.
Well, let's talk with someone else in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Comment on some of the early experimental communities like Columbia and Reston. Did kids really walk to school? That these communities were to be planned so that was one of the things that they put into the community. Whatever happened to those towns? We really hear very little about them, and now they're mature. Please comment.
Sure. Those communities were designed 3 or 4 decades ago with that same vision. Unfortunately, they lost a little bit along the way of providing the opportunities for nearby destinations so people can easily walk or bicycle to them. And as you pointed out, they did initially have that vision of scale in which people would be nearby the destinations that they would use most frequently. That's not the case today in both of those locations.
Oh, that's sad.
But you further, you want to go with that?
Thanks.
Okay. Very good. We welcome other callers. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Maybe this be a good opportunity for me to introduce again our guest, Richard Killingsworth. He's Associate Research Professor in the Department of Health Behavior and Health Education at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's also Director of Active Living by Design. This is a national initiative that's interested in trying to promote physical activity through community design. And the question, sort of the basic question we're talking about here, are there ways in which the ways our communities are designed and laid out either discourage physical activity or can encourage physical activity? And he says, in fact, yes to both of those things. We have done things that have made it difficult for people to get exercise, but by making some changes, you can create opportunities for people to do that. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. By the way, he is here to take part in the U of I's 2005 Planning Institute, looking at the issues community design for healthy lifestyles. It's sponsored by the Department of Urban and Regional Planning. We have someone else here to talk with, again, in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I wonder in terms of the schools, they were talking about, you know, walking to school and all that. What the influence of the more of a corporate structure, you know. The point I'm getting at is the consolidation. In other words, for land, as these communities build, what happened, they would do a consolidated thing and they build this great big school, you know, maybe 3, 4, 5 miles away, that kind of thing. How do we get, around this sort of this trend, you know, it seems to me that, you know, bigger is better and they just keep adding on. Are communities designed or, the newer ones were, in other words, smaller schools, smaller structures, you know, to sort of serve that particular area? Or how's that accomplished?
Yes, you're identifying a model that we are embracing, unfortunately, in which, particularly for rural areas where they're consolidating their schools into locations that are very far away from the residential community, And it's almost impossible for children to even consider bicycling, nonetheless walking to these destinations. So the challenge is how do we get schools to recognize the importance of maintaining the school within the heart of the community and the other opportunities that provides, not only just for children having the benefit of walking or bicycling, but also the school serving as a facility for the community as a whole in providing before and after school programs for the residents of that community. And this is a concept that's growing as well as communities look at shared resources and shared facilities where they're not having to duplicate facilities for different populations. They're recognizing that the school in many cases can serve multiple populations through multiple programming and also provides another source of revenue for the school to help pay off that facility and fund other programs. So I would say that, you know, the vision needs to be far and deep reach, and deep in looking at how the school serves the whole population of the community, not just for the children, and particularly this issue of safe routes to school, which is a very important topic around transportation and building systems to support that. The EPA recently released a report about school site locations. It's on their website. And looking at all the different issues that school siting and how that impacts the future sustainability of that community around issues of transportation and health and the economy. And I would encourage you to look at that and use that document as a resource if you're trying to petition your district to maintain a school within the heart of the community.
Well, thank you.
Thanks. Well, this gets at a serious bottom line economic issue. I know it's certainly a lot of rural communities, they feel that they've been forced into making those kind of choices because their student bases have shrunk and the cost of maintaining older buildings and just doing the educational enterprise go up. And it gets to the point where they say, look, it's not cost effective for us to maintain all of these buildings with the student populations we have and the economic base we have. So the thing we've got to do is band together and do just what you've said. Maybe we'll build a new building and we'll consolidate and we bring all these kids together. So maybe we have to transport them some distance. That's the most cost-effective way. Now, it sounds like what you're saying is going at a debt thinking about the school building as being more of a multifunction building for a community, and that maybe the way that is possible is by getting other sources of revenue other than that traditional way that we have supported the schools. But again, I'd say that would mean you'd have to get people to think really differently about what that building is, what it's for, and how to support it.
And correct, David. I mean, this is the whole opportunity of what we're talking about, that this issue really moves well beyond the simple topic of physical activity. Okay. We're talking about people hopping out of their silos of thinking. And that's unfortunately how we've designed our decision-making within local government. As transportation thinks one way, city planning thinks another, parks and recreation thinks one way, public health thinks another. And unfortunately, the communication across those silos is often chaotic and difficult and confusing because funding streams are channeled specifically for each one. Mm-hmm. And we really need to think about how we alter that and change that if we want to think about sustainability, particularly, especially economically within our communities. That we're building systems now that do not allow us to really reach far into the future and be able to support that with the systems that we have in place now. So what we're trying to suggest with this approach through public health is that we're providing a very simple recommendation of getting people more active, but they need a better environment in which to do that. We need to move away from a lot of the individually based approaches that we've considered to look at how other disciplines like planning and transportation architecture impact these public health outcomes. So this becomes much larger than this issue of public health. It becomes very cross-cutting in many, many different locations.
Other callers here. Let's go next to Champaign, line 2. Hello.
Hi, I'm so glad that you've written this book. This is something I've been interested in for a really long time. What I wanted to ask you is, you were talking about creating an environment that's conducive to more active lifestyles, and for me, I have been trying to walk and bike around Champaign and Urbana for several months, and it is such an uphill battle. I think that one of the major problems is that there is just no driver education as far as how to act or around pedestrians and cyclists is concerned. And it seems to me like that is a major infrastructure problem. And I was wondering if you have any ideas about how driver education can be implemented so that walking and biking is actually a safe option. I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay.
That's an excellent observation and point to make, is that most people do not know how to respond to pedestrian and bicyclists because they aren't ones themselves. So we are grown up from the time that we're born to the time we're 16 to recognize really only one travel mode. And I think when we do get our license, we don't recognize the needs of the pedestrian or the bicyclist on the road because we have no other way. And I think it should be a clear opportunity that we need to provide an infrastructure for people to engage those behaviors more often and regularly, especially if they're going to be driving, so they recognize the needs of those populations, especially for bicyclists who need to access the road with automobiles and share the road safely and effectively with automobiles. So I think there needs to be more education on both sides for people to understand that it is a shared road and that we need to develop a system that is a little bit more robust and has equity built in it for all the users, from the pedestrian to the motorist.
Yeah. And that's, I guess that, again, is an example that just shows you how in a particular community, I think in some respects there are places in Champaign-Urbana that are really good and that others not so good. As someone who in the past has been a cyclist, yeah, believe me, I know there's some places where if you want to get from point A to point B on your bike, it's like taking your life in your hands to do that. And on the by the same token, there are other places that where it's set up very well. So it kind of depends on where you are and where you want to go. And I'm sure that that is true in a lot of other communities as well.
Right. And we're talking about a behavior that is rarely seen in most communities. Most people are not do not have enough exposure to bicyclists to understand how to operate within that realm with the bicyclist. And the more people we can put on the road that can bicycle and be pedestrians, the more people begin to understand how they can respond to them and work with them and be in the same environment safely with them.
Would the ultimate goal be to create, in a sense, separate systems so that the cyclists and the cars really don't have to occupy the same space together?
Very controversial topic, David. And I would suggest not to develop separate systems because it is a costly way of approaching that paradigm. I would say that the systems can be shared, and they should be shared. That there is no reason why a car and a bike can share the same road. They're both vehicles on the road. It's the idea of educating people how to operate safely and effectively together. Now, do we need separate systems? Yes, because remember, we're trying to change a population of people to adopt a behavior that they don't recognize as being beneficial to them. So they need to be in a system that provides a safe response to that, a safe opportunity for that. So the massive movement of converting rail lines into trails is a clear opportunity of getting people engaged in bicycling and walking in that environment. But at the same time, we need to recognize we need to build a better system in the current environment.
Yeah. All right, let's go next to someone listening in Indiana, line 4.
Looks like the call's really lit up after that.
Oh, yeah. Hello.
Hello.
Go ahead. Yes.
First mention of cost effectiveness. My mind reeled into value-laden thought, because that's never usually considered. You know, in some sense, if we'd had the public control and philosophy, we could have nipped a lot of this stuff in the bud, and instead of having huge conglomerates, you know, 4,000-seat high school, we might have, say, a couple at 1,000 and a couple other small ones, you know, and just a little bit more in cost, perhaps. But the question I have is very speculative. The relationship between the environment and the, I guess we'll say, the mental brains that come out of it. I think of, like, being a small child and stepping out of a ghetto area, and all you've got is, you know, 25-story buildings all around you, and you can't see anything, basically. Then to the idyllic life I had as a youngster growing up in a small town in the Midwest, where if I wanted to go see some corn, all I had to do was maybe go 8 or 12 blocks in one direction, and you know all the storybook stuff. Unfortunately, it was pretty much true from my experience. So I wonder if there's any philosophical things going on here, especially in terms of the values that we're sort of crushing by the cost-effective procedures.
Well, I think you're identifying that we don't have a true vision of all the connectedness of the the things that we're trying to design and develop and sustain over time. So the school example that you provided, for most, they see that as a clear cost savings initially in bringing schools together in one location and having a streamlined approach of how the educational system operates through that perspective without maybe realizing or recognizing what the other maybe unintended outcomes may result from that. And that's what we often do. We make recommendations in public health and in transportation and planning. We recognize what some of the immediate positive and negative outcomes may be through our experience with that, but we don't necessarily think about what all the unintended consequences may be as a result of the recommendation. So I would, you know, caution everyone to think about when you make decisions, think about all those unintended parameters, those unintended situations that may result from those decisions, as in the case of building consolidated school districts. Maybe a nice opportunity to have a beautiful facility that is located in one area, but what happens as a result of that to the surrounding communities and to the heart of those communities by locating those schools further away?
Yeah, okay. Let's go to next caller. This is someone in Terre Haute, also Indiana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Wonderful program. I want to ask the question for your man to comment on this. Does capitalism somehow interfere with these plans? Okay, the reason I ask that is I was married for a while to a Russian doctor, and we lived in a little, in a community just outside of Moscow that was built around a research institute. And they were three-story apartment buildings, beautiful things, and built around like a park-like area. And so you could go out of your building and to a park, a real nice park that was maintained. And then schools, there was about, there were different levels of schools right there. I don't think they were more than, the most would be three blocks through the park. There was grocery stores and even furniture stores nearby. There was a full clinic with laboratories right in the heart of things. And you had basically everything you needed. You never needed to go outside of the town. There was swimming pools and the sauna baths in the institute. And they had all kinds of educational activities for young kids. And you didn't need a car. And then outside of this area, they had rail or bus transportation into the city. But you seldom needed to go into it. Hmm. And it seems to me, well, or maybe you could comment on that, or the Soviet building experiment in the 30s and the 40s. And I notice now that when they put up a housing development, that it comes in and they have stores, grocery stores and laundries and everything else that come right with it. So people can move in and they don't need to travel far. Okay, that was basically
okay. Well, I appreciate the question, the comment. What do you think?
Well, you know, what was coming to mind, obviously that's way beyond the realm of my experience in the looking at, particularly at the political ideology of how some of these things happen. But, you know, he was mentioning a number of different amenities that is part of the movement within New Urbanism, is locating all those types of facilities within within destinations that are close to where people live and work and where they go to school. I think we clearly recognize, and the research shows, that when we have good land use mix, that people will respond better to that. We'll have a better environment, not only to function within it, but to care for it and to make it part of the community experience. And I think that's some of the part that's lacking in many of the neighborhoods in which we live, is that we are lacking the investment to making sure that community thrives far into the future, because we're a very transient society now. We're moving from place to place, and few of us develop deep roots within those communities. So I think the true test of most of these new urbanist communities that are being developed now is how long will people stay there and how much of an investment will they make to nurture that environment, to make sure that it sustains itself far into the future. As the gentleman was pointing out, that makes that place a true community.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and as you say, I think it's important to acknowledge the fact that, that there are communities like that in the United States, places that, again, people have built from the ground up, and that there are also places where they are taking existing communities and they're trying to incorporate some of the features here that we've talked about. So it seems more to have to do with, do you start out with that as being part of your values? And that's something that probably transcends a lot of other stuff.
Right.
If you start out saying, okay, this is what we are, think is important in a community, and either we're going to build that from the ground up, or we're going to look at what we've got now, and we're going to say, okay, what can we do with it?
Yeah, and it gets at the issue, a question that is often asked, you know, can we compare ourselves to the European model, looking at how Europe is designed and really clearly supports much of what we're talking about through bicycling and walking. It's two very different systems to compare. And we're talking different political systems, and we're talking about a more mature environment that has quite a bit of experience in doing this work. And plus, they're constrained by a number of land constraints, first of all, and space constraints to do this work. So they really have to maximize the potential of how they spend the resources and how they support different modes of transportation. And the most cost-effective mode to support, obviously, is the walking, the non-motorized, the walking and the bicycling. So that's where the best investment will be made, because it's the least expensive to support over time.
Hmm. To another caller here, I want to thank the last caller and go to next, Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that description of the place in Russia. But I don't think you quite answered his question. Do you think there's a political dimension to your movement? I was interested in that question myself, because we're losing a place to walk here in Urbana at the local mall. It's going to be no longer enclosed, and a lot of people used to go there and walk a half hour, 45 minutes. And despite the fact that a conservative, fairly high-profile politician, a local politician, walked there all the time, we're still losing it. And I've got one other question I wanted to ask you.
Sure. I guess the basic question, is this a political issue? Well, clearly it is. And I think what we're trying to do is depoliticize the agendas at stake here and to recognize that what people are asking for are simple choices within the environment. People are supporting a variety of topics within this issue for a number of different reasons. And yes, I would say it's political from that perspective. But let's depoliticize what we're talking about, and let's get at what the true public and political will is to put these things in place. It's a heavy – we're talking about a heavy load to bear and a heavy load to implement this work. And I think what people need to have is a true vision for the community and to put policy in place that institutionalizes that vision over time. In the absence of policy, what you're identifying there with this situation with the pedestrian mall and the mall is there's an absence of policy to say that the vision for this community is going to keep that intact, is going to support it, and to make systems maintain that over time to where that becomes a true facility for this community far into the future. So I guess my argument would be, let's depoliticize what we've politicized, and let's look at the true value of having choices within the environment for all people, young and old, or regardless of ability.
I think to an extent we did that. In the last election, we got rid of the present mayor, and may have been played a factor. And then my other question is, on campus, there used to be a lot of walking being done at the Armory, and it's been restricted a lot. But I was just curious, and just in over looking at the country in general, do you see a lot of like National Guard armories? Because we still have one in Urbana here, being opened up to walkers. And how about the situation with like running tracks at high schools?
Yeah, and that's, again, as I mentioned to an earlier caller, the shared use facility policy is becoming more prevalent across the U.S. We're recognizing that public facilities and government facilities need to be opened up to the larger community for everyone to use, and becomes a cost-effective issue from that perspective.
So you are seeing that opening up, and who's taking the lead? Is it the politicians, or is it from the grassroots?
Well, it's coming from grassroots. I think demonstrating that there is will to have this in place, and certainly leveraging that with the elected officials and in those municipalities. I'm not certain about the Armory situation, but other public facilities that are not so driven by national security issues or defense mechanism certainly should be able to respond to that request.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. To another caller here, somebody listening on a cell phone. This would be line number two. Hello.
Good morning, David Inch and Professor Richard Chillingsworth. Professor, what is the most significant single design improvement which, during your visit, you have noticed that Champaign-Urbana or the university could make? Thank you.
Wow, what a powerful question in my short stay here. And I would argue that there isn't one single thing that can be done to really serve as a catalyst. I think it's an opportunity of building an aggregate of a system where we're looking at multiple things feeding into each other to serve the population that lives here. And if you had to identify, one general domain to look at, it would be how we provide a better pedestrian environment for people to get from destination to destination. I think you have a great start here. You're on a grid system. You have excellent sidewalk network, beautiful tree canopies on those sidewalks, and beautiful residential environment. It's one of the few towns that I see that has really maintained well where people live and where they work and have dedicated a system to support that to some level. In the absence of, however, I would probably argue, is a true campaign around making sure people use those facilities. Often we're caught up in this built environment fallacy that if we build a trail or if we build a sidewalk network or a bikeway system that people will respond to it immediately. And that's not often the case. And in most situations, that doesn't happen at the level that we think it will. So I would argue that there needs to be more marketing and communications around why this is important. And remember, we started this show off talking about the behavior of physical activity. Mm-hmm. It's an issue that is striking at a very important epidemic in the United States, which is obesity. So the issue is how do we use systems of the built environment through planning and transportation to address a public health outcome like inactivity and obesity and diabetes? And unless we get the right people at the table from all those disciplines to affect that, I don't think we're going to have change. And Champaign is trying to address that. Champaign-Urbana is trying to address that through a number of different mechanisms. The people need to respond to it.
Yeah. It's difficult to... For example, in the city of Urbana, the previous caller made reference to this mall, this place called Lincoln Square. Mm-hmm. It's one of the first enclosed malls ever built in the United States. That's in the heart of Urbana, within easy walking distance to a lot of residential areas. And at one point, it was a thriving mall, had various kinds of retail stores. There was a grocery store. There was a pharmacy. It really offered a lot of opportunities for people to go by bike or to walk to access a pretty wide range of retail. But what happened over time is when the first big mall was built, regional mall,
right.
It killed it. And then, of course, the trend has been more and more to those kinds of things. We have more of them. We have the big box stores. And now just recently, and maybe you can argue about whether or not it was the right thing to do, the mall has for many years been languishing. And now we apparently have an agreement between the city and the people who have the mall and a large healthcare institution in our community to turn it into a kind of a mixed use place where there's going to be some apartments, there's going to be some offices, there may be still some retail, but it's not going to be what it once was and what people thought that it could be. So here in trying to turn that trend around and trying to make the downtown a thriving place once again, for all those people who are in easy access of it, it seems that you're really swimming against a very strong tide. And that's why it is that we have the retail patterns that we do now. And now, for example, now here we have these two cities that are together. The city of Champaign up in the northwestern part has been turned into a vast strip mall.
Right.
And if you do want certain things, maybe you got to go there. And the only way that you're going to – well, we do have pretty good mass transportation, so you could take a bus. But a lot of people say, well, really the way to do it is you got to hop in the car and you got to go up there. I mean, how do you turn – that around?
Well, it seems like you're beginning to address some of that. How do we revitalize that mall into something that serves the community at large? And the first mistake, obviously, as you pointed out, was the development of a regional mall that pulled the lifeblood out of that location without having the vision of what was going to happen. Remember, that was an unintended consequence from a decision that was made because they saw the immediate dollar sign return on that investment as opposed to the long-range issue of what's it going to cost us down the road when this mall collapses and then takes the lifeblood of the community around it away with it. So I think we need to look more carefully about how we're designing systems that support this, the big box retail, how it pulls out the local merchant and doesn't allow that merchant to thrive in the neighborhood in which he or she resides. So what we're talking about here is how we build a complex system that serves the heart of the community and also at the same time meets our basic needs for functioning. And remember, the show is about physical activity. Yeah. It's how we become physically active through these systems approaches and address a very basic need for humans to be active and to address all these wonderful health outcomes that result because we are physically active.
We're going to have to stop there. We have come a little ways from the place that we started out. However, I do want to mention that for people who are interested in learning more about active living by design, about our guest, Richard Killingsworth, also have the opportunity to read some things that he has written on this subject. A lot of information is available on their website. So if you do have internet access, you can go to www.activelivingbydesign.org. and find out all of that material. Richard Killingsworth, Director of Active Living by Design. He is also Associate Research Professor in the Department of Health Behavior and Health Education at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanks very much.
Thanks, David. Thank you.